And now there's an impulse coming out of Kirchner, Argentina, and a guy named Correa's Ecuador, with other countries organizing around it. Brazil's Lula, Venezuela's Chavez, and Chile's Bachelet as the real primary people that are organizing around this. They're proposing a Bank of the South, a South American Development Bank. This is coming along the same lines as what López Obrador was saying. He, was, of course, was the victor of the Mexican elections last summer. Massive vote fraud stolen from him. And you got this guy in there now who's a Bush crony.
Fox.
No, he replaced Fox.
Calderon.
Yeah. Felipe Calderon. You know, they found dumpsters full of ballots that weren't counted. Calderon had tallied up more votes in districts than there were registered voters. Stuff like this. This is the kind of vote fraud that went on there. What they're trying to do in the South is unify around an economic perspective, which keeps the IMF and Western rapers out of their nation. So that's very promising. But it's only promising insofar as the United States gets rid of Cheney, gets rid of Bush, if necessary, gets rid of really a level of cultural pessimism that will allow a classical tragedy to occur. Right, a good example of this is Shakespeare's plays. There's an irony within this as well. Because in Caesar and in Hamlet, you have the same phenomenon, where individuals are debased by a degenerate culture, which is egging them on, in a sense, which is commending them for being debased, for being immoral, for lacking courage. Right? In both cases, they end up in you just shaking your head how insane the whole situation was. The whole time you're like, do this, no, do this, no, don't do that, what are you doing that for? Right? Like, oh, you did that, what the fuck? Right? You're watching this tragedy unfold, and you leave the theater thinking, damn, what a bunch of fools. And if you're intelligent, you don't walk out there going, what a fool. You reflect on what caused that fool to be such a fool, and all the other fools around him to be so foolish. And in Caesar, there's this discussion between Cassius and Brutus, where just very frankly they reflect upon the situation with Caesar in power and them complaining about him, etc. And they say the fault, Cassius says, the fault, dear Brutus, lies not in ourselves, not in our stars, but in ourselves, that we are underlings. Right? He's saying, well, the fault doesn't lie in some divine plan for us, but the fault lies in the fact that we don't see ourselves as strong, courageous human beings. And in a sense, he's trying to organize for Caesar's overthrow. Shakespeare's kind of twisting this, though. And he brings this line in. The fault, dear Brutus, lies not in our stars, but in ourselves, that we are underlings. Then in Hamlet, you've got a similar situation right at the beginning, where one of the characters, I think it's Horatio, says to Maurizio, he says, I don't have the direct quote, but he says, the fault's in the stars. He's quoting, he's actually citing Julius Caesar's historical reference in this line. And he says, the fault, our problem's in our stars. Right? So obviously, characters of Hamlet did not learn from Julius Caesar. Because in Caesar, he's saying, no, the problem's not in our stars, but in ourselves. And Hamlet's saying, no, the problem's in ourselves. Then you know the story of Hamlet. The guy convinces himself or acts crazy in order to avoid facing a real challenge. And he's just driven insane, drives himself insane. And so you got someone like Jim McDermott, right? He's been in the House of Representatives for 20 years. He walks into a room. All his constituents are there. The only young people who are there are holding Lyndon LaRouche's literature, passing them out to people, talking to them, getting their phone numbers, doing outreach, as we've been doing in his community for the last 7 years now, as a youth movement. And he gets up there and he starts talking, and he's facing a lynch mob, saying, impeach, 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 impeach. And we get up and we brief him on classical tragedy. And we say to him the very line Christ said about the man on the road to Jericho. The question is not about whether what happens to me if I stop to help him. The question is what happens to him if I do not stop and help him. That's the paradox that we pose to this guy McDermott. Saying this is classical tragedy. This is how you're behaving. Look at your argument. We're about to face a war with Iran, goddammit. If this happens, Russia's in our sights. China's in our sights. The very nations which I just went through a development perspective for will be our combatants. And you're not willing to do something that's uncomfortable? We put you there! You're not working for Nancy Pelosi. You're not working for the dictator, whoever you think that is. Right? You're working for the people. That's where the power lies in changing politics. It's in the people. The only way you reach people is if you understand people. Because we're all one. We have a unique insight into what a person is. We all happen to be one. Okay, so... You know, sometimes you got to point out the obvious here. They don't lose anybody. So therefore, as a youth movement, what we're really investigating is what exactly is a human being? What exactly is the potential of a human being's mind? Who truly expressed genius in history? Who do you think? Who do you think was a genius in history? Who do you think was like truly, truly human? Like, acted in a way that...
Einstein.
Einstein. What about you? No. No one.
Who did you say? Robert Plant.
No one could play a scale like Robert Plant. Hi, welcome.
Hi.
You here for the yoga class?
Right.
Okay. We were just asking people who they thought in history exhibited a certain quality of genius. Who do you think?
Jesus.
Why do you say Jesus? Jesus? Huh?
Love is Jesus.
What'd you say?
Do you love him no matter what is genius?
So love is a form of genius?
Absolutely.
Okay. Did you tell that to Britney Spears? I think she believed you. Trying to experiment with genius.
What's it, Plato?
Plato. Socrates. Why do you say that?
I think Socrates, my favorite line from him,
It's either or. Why did you say Einstein?
For me, it was because he was very humanitarian in many ways, even though he made maybe some, not of any fault of his own, discoveries that may have hurt people. But I think in the end, when you read the quotes and read what he said, he was very much pro-humanitarian in many ways. He was a very intelligent man.
Hey, buddy, before you leave.
I must leave.
Who do you think? She did? This woman here?
No, I'm sorry.
You're not taking this love thing to your head, are you? You're not going to try to be a genius, are you?
Anyway, I'm terribly sorry.
Okay. All right. Bathrooms are... Rob, who do you think is a genius? Ben Franklin? Why?
Because of the gift he gave through the cultivation of people like Hamilton and John Quincy Adams. And dedicating much of his life to something that he didn't even really get to enjoy.
No, it's funny, right? Because a lot of these people that you guys mentioned are like they're Renaissance individuals in the sense that they're engaged in all kinds of different pursuits, right? Like Kel brought up this thing, right? Franklin invented electricity, but he also established fundamentally a philosophical basis, which became the youth movement that created the American Constitution, the American Republic. Individuals like Lincoln coming out of this circle of people. So you have this notion, like what Rob's bringing up, right, of genius actually participating in future development. Each one of these people that we've mentioned also is dead. So something they've done within the bookends of birth and death has lived on to the point where we now can cite them as an authority, in some cases 2,300 years old. Right? So the question within LaRouche's economics is two things. One, how do we cultivate genius within the developing population? And two, how do individuals, within the bookends of their birth and death, actually have the potential to have this living sense of immortality. Right now, given the current economic situation, current economic circumstances, where 70% of China and India are necessarily in poverty in order for, you know, globalization to work. I'm not advocating it. I'm saying it's necessary for the system. That's really 70% of those countries which don't have the ability to, in a similar situation as this, be named as a genius or as immortal. The 70% of the planet which is in a situation so dire that they don't have access to really what separates them from being an animal. Right? Animals live and die. No gorilla is hailed by all gorilla kind as being a genius 2,000 years after their death. You don't have like a revolutionary termite that totally changed living conditions for all termite kind. Right? This is very, very uniquely human. So as a youth movement, we're investigating this notion of humanity through the rediscovery of Franklin's genius, of Einstein's genius, Socrates' genius, Christ's genius, of LaRouche's genius, which luckily is accessible to us today, of right now, in a very concentrated way, Johannes Kepler's genius, and coupled with that, Isaac Newton's stupidity, along with Johann Sebastian Bach's genius.
And Frederick Schiller.
Right, and others. Et al. And you have, throughout history, ideas, say, coming out of Socrates, which inspired people like Jesus, and inspired people like Kuza, inspired people like Kepler, to make a fundamental discovery as to what universal gravitation is. And what we're doing is we're actually trying to map it as such. We're trying to map this genius as it developed through these individuals. Look at science from a historical standpoint in the sense that, totally revolutionary concept, we're actually going to read what they wrote. Unlike some university telling us the soundbite of Newton and the soundbite of Kepler and the soundbite of so-and-so, all put together by, you know, some Cambridge University aristocrat in a textbook, 8th edition, published 2006. We're going to go back and read Kepler, which the person at Cambridge University doesn't want you to do.
Probably didn't do himself.
Yeah, right.
What's he afraid of?
Hmm?
What's he afraid of? Why doesn't he want you?
Yeah, that's a good question. Because Kepler got at this notion of genius from the standpoint of communicating it to you. Kepler's notion of gravitation was completely revolutionary. He did it by looking at the solar system. His idea of gravity is such, people have different ideas of gravity, and often of it is just this Newtonian quackery that I'm attracted to Luke, I'm attracted to this bag, I'm attracted to this pen, the pen's attracted to me, the bag, and Luke. That everything there's this, like, attraction to, right? Versus Kepler's notion, which is that the solar system is a harmonically ordered system, constantly striving for perfection. And perfection, as such, is that process of striving, that process of change. That the solar system, at one point, was nothing but a sun, which spun out a disk, which generated higher atoms, which cooled, which settled in predefined harmonic orders, which are knowable through the investigation of the musical scale as to where they are and why they're there and no other place. Harmony. The solar system is harmonically ordered. A change in the sun means a change in the earth. A comet flying into the sun's magnetic field throws off the Earth's and causes climate change. The Earth getting closer to Jupiter throws off the Earth's magnetic field and causes climate change. The solar system, think about it. The Earth is just flying around the sun in an ordered way that you can know, along with Mars, the asteroids, Jupiter, in a way that you can know. What's keeping them there? Because there's one point on the Earth's orbit where it's actually moving farther away from the sun. It's going farther and farther away from the sun because it's an ellipse, right? Then there's one point where all of a sudden it starts moving closer towards it. Why doesn't it just, like, keep going? Is it thinking? Is the planet going, I've got to take a left, hard left, hard left? That's close. No, Kepler's idea is that the universe is thinking, in a sense. The planet's not thinking. The universe is tuning the solar system. This point, the farthest point, where it makes this turn in, it's called the aphelion. You take a violin string, right? From one to the other, Sun to Mars, relative distances, right? We're not going to take a violin string that long. Relative distances. Then you take Earth's aphelion, right? Could be anywhere along this string. And you pinch it. You get a harmonic interval. Every single case, the aphelion, the perihelion, Mars to Jupiter, Jupiter to Earth. Kepler discovered a bounding principle of the universe. He discovered that your mind can know the creators in a way that's not approximating a cause from the standpoint of taking astronomical data and then drawing a bunch of circles on a piece of paper and saying, well, this explains what I see. You guys get the difference? One, you're taking data, empirical data, and enslaving it to a model which you create. The other of which is an investigation, what Kepler did, of how the physical universe works. From there, asking the question, given the fact that a musical string is ordered in this way, given the fact that a circle is harmonic in this way, given the fact that a sphere generates proportional harmonies in this way, why is that doing that and nothing else? From the standpoint of investigating the universe, how can we know better the universe? That's where Kepler goes. Now, after his discoveries, his work was buried. And you didn't get an English translation of it until 1985.
When was it buried?
It was buried in 1609. Well, after his death in
1630.
By circles around the Venetians. The same people who were trying to convince people in Britain to write what later Isaac Newton did as his Principia. We have a group of individuals who are now engaged on a month-long process. That's their political deployment. They are in a 4 or 5 month investigative process of how Gauss took Kepler's ideas and discovered the orbit of the asteroid Ceres in 1800, 200 years after Kepler. Because Gauss doesn't tell you. Kepler tells you. Gauss was afraid. He had Napoleon running around. Science at that time was very, very political. As a 23-year-old kid, he refuted Napoleon's mathematician and became under incredible political scrutiny, watch, etc. And so he would put out these discoveries but never tell anybody how he did them. Because what's dangerous is the method. Right? F equals ma. What's dangerous about that? Nothing. Gravity, 9.8 meters per second squared. What's dangerous about that? Nothing. Because what can you do with it? Well, you can explain how this falls. Can you use a method in which you can explain how this falls to figure out the organizational structure of, say, the nucleus? No. Can you use this method to then totally transform science as it stands? No. Because you don't know how that was fundamentally discovered. You know the diarrhea of the discovery. You know the end product. You know the fertilizer that allows other generations to employ that discovery. But not know how the creative mind that discovered it was actually thinking. That's power. That's dangerous. The oligarchy quells that, shuts that up, assassinates that. That's the seeds of Renaissance. That's the seeds of republicanism. That's what Benjamin Franklin was doing. If it wasn't for his organizing, you wouldn't have had this as a fossil of his life.
Why do you think so many people are scared of it?
Well, I mean, we got a very self-conscious culture in the bad sense of the word. And quite frankly, people tend to do what's comfortable because it's what's popular. It's what's easy. It's what they've always done. It's what other people are doing.
So how do you inspire curiosity? How do you fill the room?
Well, I mean, in a sense, we've done it.
So how do you do it? That's what I say. How do you tap into it? You always see tapped into a few people went, smells good. Let up all that smell. Go there.
Mm-hmm.
And other people walk on by.
Well, it's this process. We need more of it.
So not everyone's comfortable.
Yeah. I mean, the solution concept lies in your ability to communicate a real idea versus 9.8 meters per second squared, versus a soundbite, versus a single issue. Gay marriage, bullshit. I don't want to hear about it, you know? What the hell's a human being? That's a political discussion. From there, you can get into policy. But unless you're relating to people on a superficial level, you're not acknowledging that you're actually talking to a thinking, cognitive human soul. You're not trying more and more intently to actually access that soul and give that person who's existing in a culture which is a constraint upon that soul to come out of their shells, so to speak. To then say, well, okay, you take the case of Kepler. Understand Kepler's mind. You got to basically say, I'm going to give myself to the guy for 5,000 hours. Probably. I'm going to give my soul to his for 5,000 hours. To truly understand Einstein, what may have been lacking in Einstein's ideas, a similar thing. By investigating those before, by investigating the historical circumstances under which these ideas developed. That's the work this youth movement's doing. That's why we do the music work, right? Because that defined a culture. And if you don't understand how that culture was thinking about music, and Einstein himself was a violinist, and you don't understand how these classical ideas are communicated through musical irony, you know, then you're somewhat limited. Every statesman should be a musical genius as well.
Every statesman
should be a musical genius. Better understand irony, tension, principles of communication. And it doesn't mean you gotta like go home and like start blowing on a flute or something. Like we're all given an instrument, right? Our voice. Now, Lincoln was a master. King, you can actually listen to King. King was a master at musically communicating an idea. Like, this is what the culture needs now. If we're not developing that, who will? People need inspiration. It's going to come from the young people. We're not going to convince baby boomers like Jim McDermott in Seattle to go against the Democratic Party's dictator, as he put it, and actually change the fundamental structure of policy. What we're going to do is communicate to other people's souls an idea about what our potential is right now, given what's coming out of Putin, given what's coming out of people inside other nations, given a general tenor that exists all over the world, where there is a destitute crisis of ungovernability. Africa has been ungovernable for centuries. Europe now is ungovernable with the euro. China, it's governable in the extent that their population is still able to be exploited. India, similar thing. Central and South America, decimated. Their drug economy. The people there know that.
How do you get an entire continent
Well, we were going to have to organize a real revolution in policy.
I know the formula, create cognitive dissonance, shock and awe, slam some planes into the World Trade Center, and people are going to wake people up, and they're going to accept change. They're going to ask for help, and they're going to accept change.
Mm-hmm. That's how the Nazis did it, too. Yeah, that's one way.
That's how I do it. That sometimes on an individual basis.
You getting your pilot's license or something?
I have a feeling what it could very well be is a cataclysmic sort of event, which essentially will get people to, okay, well, we're at that point, we need to think this way. And that could very well be what happens, unfortunately, which is what you don't want.
Well, it's happening now, and what you see in Seattle exemplifies it. It's the potential of a cataclysmic event. It's being so close, which is self-organizable. Now, in and of itself, that is a misnomer, self-organizable. Because people's reaction to a crisis exists within the structure and the realm of what is socially imposed upon them as being acceptable. And what you have today is a propensity towards Jacobinism. I can tell you an anecdote from a convention that I was at in Massachusetts, the Mass Democratic Party convention, where our youth movement had been going for 3 years now. And this year, there were 12 of us who were delegates sponsored by the Democratic Party to vote on issues and resolutions, etc., on the floor. There's 1,200 delegates, 12,000 participants in the convention. There were four resolutions put forward before the entire committee, the entire convention. Two of those were put forward by our youth movement. Right? As the Democratic Party was scrambling for, you know, different ways of, from the established Democratic Party to recruit youth, half of the resolutions proposed were from a youth movement. So there was an irony there, implicit in the fact that two young people from our movement addressed the entire convention of 12,000 people and organized them around, one, the insanity of the economic situation, and two, the necessity to impeach Bush and Cheney. In our case, two of the resolutions proposed, one from the Progressive Democrats of America, the other from us, were both impeachment resolutions. The population wants impeachment more than anything in the world right now, more than ice cream. Even pistachio ice cream. The Progressive Democrats of America said, we're going to impeach Bush and Cheney, get them out because they're bad. That was it. Our resolution said, we call on the mass delegation in Congress to support unanimously Dennis Kucinich's bill, H.R. 333, which is already in motion, which says that Cheney's about to nuke Iran and get him out before he nukes Iran. We got up in front of the convention and says, look, our bill is better than theirs. Vote ours. Because here you have the communication of an actual idea that Cheney is moving towards doing the same thing with Iran that he did with Iraq, with the same line, the same wool is being pulled over the same eyes, and let's actually get at the source. Let's not be vengeful and rageful and get at Vanna White for turning over the wrong letter. That's essentially what George W. Bush is. He's a messenger. He's an idiot messenger who's dreaming about the time he once snorted a line of cocaine longer than his bottle of Jack Daniels. Right? But he's a messenger. And the party voted for the other one. They voted for the double impeachment because they're bad. Now that's a tendency within our culture. Move towards what's easy. Move towards what appeals to me immediately. Moves to what is immediately gratifying. What makes me feel the best is get them both out. Even if it's not the most thought out. about, even if it's not the most reasonable, even if it's not the best way of going about it. If we're going to organize a revolution in policy, and we're going to do it from the base of the parties, we're going to do it from the base of the population, we've got to do it around reason. We don't want to hit the streets and emotionally work people up and emotionally rile people up so that they get excited as you are right now. Right? It's a question of actually thinking through, well, you know, what is the most functional way of going about this. Now, Lynn has done it, and I suggest everybody here to pick up as much as they can read by this guy LaRouche. Because what he's saying about economic reform, what he's saying about the reason why you impeach Cheney, the reason why you'd stop a war with Iran, the reason why you'd get the Queen out of Canada, the reason why you'd create a tunnel going under the Bering Strait, it's for a very specific philosophical conception of man, which we as a human race must uphold. The idea of man that we're creative. Let's explore that. As a youth movement, let's explore that. What are the boundaries of that creativity? How did Kepler do it? How then did he communicate something which Gauss employed, which he didn't communicate? How then did Riemann understand a conception of hypergeometry that allowed Einstein to make his discovery in a limited way? And track this. Get a much firmer, within that, a much firmer understanding of history and the historical currents that were pushing so-and-so in one direction and so-and-so in another. Because we're young, we can assess this now and we can make the right decision rather than the wrong. You've got to maintain a constant level of introspection, of self-reflection. Asking yourself, well, where'd that come from? Where'd that come from? Where'd that come from?
I think that's a really important point. It's probably the most important thing you said in the last 3 minutes. That if you don't sit back and go, where'd that come from? Where did I get this? That implies everything you purchase, everything you drink, everything that you invest your time, because you're young, you have time for this. It has power. We have so much power.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like if you buy a pair of jeans, who made it? You mentioned that a bit, Matthew, but you know, you get a cup of coffee, who sold the beans? Who made the plane? And when you start realizing that every choice, every thought has weight, and you can actually ripple effect from where you're sitting now to those bad boys in power in the White House this week, has a lot of power. If you decide, I'm not going to take the car to work, I'm going to walk or ride the bus because I don't want to buy the gas, I don't want to feed the oil or whatever. That's one person.
Right, but it's pretty powerless.
Well, if you get 10 people who talk about it and then 20 people.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the big problem, though, generally speaking, is that it's getting people to ask those questions. It's to get people to feel uncomfortable. And Canadians especially are very, very, very comfortable.
Right.
And it's hard to get out of that comfort level to ask those questions. Where did this come from? Because if you're going to ask where did those beans come from, they're not going to necessarily have that answer. Therefore, you have to consciously walk away from that coffee.
Right. However, if you meet someone for coffee, I agree with you, but if you meet someone for coffee, they won't have coffee, they'll have this. They go, would you like coffee? I'm like, yeah, but, or I'll meet you at the bus stop. I'm like, what, you don't drive? No. Why not? Well, at your age, you don't drive? No. Why not? And people are taking a lot of things for granted, like having a bath every day. On water in this country, and you have water, that's like a kazoo where someone has to walk 5 miles for a cup. I can have a bath every day. Those conversations can be had on a regular basis.
The problem which you're trying to address is a problem which does not lie necessarily in the individual, it's reflected in the individual. But it lies in a system which that individual is operating in.
Right, of course.
Now, complicity to that system while you're in the system, or non-complicity to that system while you're in the system of thought, of social interaction, of a general liberal culture, is still operating within the bounds of that system and not acting upon those boundaries. If, however, One gets a sense of what I'm talking about with genius and instills upon them a subjective realization that it's the decisions I make now which can affect that system, not necessarily in the small as to what clothes I wear, but as to how day to day I'm communicating the ideas and the solution concepts that can change that system from outside the system. For example, no parliamentarian is going to stand up and read Canada's Declaration of Independence. No Wall Street banker is going to get up and say, globalization, as we now know it, is finished. Now you don't have to make that choice with the coffee. Right? Thanks to everybody that made that choice with the coffee, we're not making the profits to reverse globalization. Reverse 30 years of economic decadence and bring back Franklin Roosevelt. When you're talking about a problem which is this ingrained in society, to the point where, as individuals, we've accepted the fact that 70% of China and India must necessarily remain in poverty for our system to continue, then you must address a fundamental generating cause and a fundamental generating principle, and with the realization that you can know an intent behind that given system. The intent being that the United States eventually would be pinned up against Russia, that warfare would inevitably be ravaged throughout the world, that oligarchism and a principle of financier rule over that of a strong nation state would actually be accepted by the population. The solution within that problem lies in changing the system generating that problem. You're not going to better the lives of that that coffee producer by boycotting Starbucks. You know, Mr. LaRouche was asked this question at a cadre school that we had, a similar meeting like this in Seattle. Someone said, "Mr. LaRouche, you know, I'm a machinist and I'm 25 years old. You know, A, I can't find any work, and B, all my coworkers are 60. He's like, "How do we get like welding skills and machining skills to youth?" Lin says, "Well, you got to go to the top. You've got to create a project between four nations: Russia, China, India, and the United States, with Canada playing a special role in putting this Bering Strait Tunnel, this maglev project, into effect, like Kennedy's space program." He said, "You generate this like spearhead where your whole economy then can revolve around it. And now there's a need for those young people to develop welding skills, to develop machining skills. You're not just teaching kids how to weld, you know, so that they can make a slush puppy machine or a slot machine, right? You're teaching them to weld because what they're doing is embedding the infrastructure and the life of people in that society." Now, if you go with this project, if you go with what Lin is saying here, Congress impeaching Cheney, moving massive amounts of credit, tariffs, trade regulations on imported goods, and move towards stimulating U.S. and Canadian economies around real productivity, and create a network of these train systems, which include pipelines, electricity grids, transport, freight, and passenger, going all throughout North and South America into Asia, Europe, if you do that, then the quality of living of those people is uplifted. Then the coffee farmer can't work for $2 a day because he's sending his coffee on the most state-of-the-art train system. The coffee costs more. He then gets paid more. It's not, economics is not that mechanical, that this five spot is my, you know, F you to Wall Street. They don't give a shit about money. They care about whether your nation has a say in how they make money. They care about how your nation has a say, most importantly, about whether or not you're cultivating this principle of genius. That is truly power. Power doesn't exist in a dollar. And where you spend that dollar really doesn't make two shits of a difference if you're in a system which is centered around slavery. That's what you need to act on to change. Sometimes you're in a bind and you got to drink Hortons. But if you're drinking that Hortons to wake up so you can change fundamentally the society that you're operating in, it's making Hortons possible, then, you know, maybe you're giving some dignity to those poor Bolivians that have to work for $2 a day. But that's the purpose of this organization. That's the purpose of this movement, is to act upon the problem and the real principle that's causing the problem. And that requires a deliberative process to understand that. Because so many people in our society have this liberal notion that, well, you know, while you go to Hortons and do all this crazy stuff with your coffee, I'm going to, you know, be pure in mine. But, you know, really, I'm not going to fundamentally challenge your perversity. It's a liberal notion, right? I'll let you have your lifestyle as long as your lifestyle doesn't infringe upon mine. It doesn't matter if they're both immoral, right? Because we don't talk about that. We talk about the weather. We talk about bullshit. We'll talk about bullshit for 60 years and then die, and that's it. Right? That's, in a sense, single-issue politics. Taken to a higher level. Oh, do you agree with this thing? Yeah, I agree with that thing. What about this thing? Yeah, I agree with that thing. Oh, I disagree with that thing. Oh, well, agree to disagree. Right? And in a parliamentary system, it's even more funny because you got a checklist, right? And if one check is off from the party line, well, there's a whole other party for you. Right? In American politics, the candidates define the parties. I wouldn't be a Democrat if it wasn't for Franklin Roosevelt. He's the only good thing that ever happened to the Democratic Party. And there wouldn't be a Republican Party if it wasn't for Abraham Lincoln. The necessity to create one. Because the Democrats and the Whigs were so corrupt. So that's a superior form of government. It's a superior form of running an economy. It's a shame my nation couldn't prove that to you. But in philosophy and in history, it's been proven. So now it's really a question of personal potency and of subjective realization that without the work that this youth movement's doing in trying to cultivate genius and apply it practically to political organizing, without that principle in our society today, acting upon the culture of Canada, America, Germany, Argentina, Chile, France, then the world is fucked. These ideas are dead. It's a reality. It's a subjective reality that we need to confront because we're young enough to do it. I mean, it's good to know that Polish folk music is not going to die. I guess. Chopin wrote some variations on Polish folk. So yeah, I mean, that's what we're doing. I mean, we truly are a revolutionary youth movement that are not afraid to go in the street and tell people that David Suzuki is not God. In fact, he's the opposite. He's calling for massive depopulation. Now, these ideas are not the most popular ideas in the world. Nuclear power, technological innovation, engineering, going back and mastering the ideas that have developed human history. Not doing what's easy, but doing what's hard because it's hard. That's not cool. Not hip. Not the hip thing to do. May not get you the most women. Maybe that's the exception. But it's what's morally right. It's the right thing to do. here it's funny because like we haven't been here too long. We're not too established in Canada. We kind of have to like tell people that we have a political movement. It's actually changing policy. Tons of people involved. And you guys gotta like take our word for it. So we want to change that. I mean, we want our state, the state of the organization in Canada, to empirically reflect the state of the organization elsewhere. It's growing. It's only through communicating truthful ideas that LaRouche was able to set up this movement in the first place, organizing at colleges in New York City in the 70s, giving lectures on why Marxists don't understand Marx, and why Franklin, and why Ben, I mean, Franklin Roosevelt is a superior economist. I mean, you guys could go back and listen to some of these lectures. They're fascinating. But what LaRouche has is a sense of living genius, the same living genius that Christ, that Socrates, that Einstein, Benjamin Franklin, and others have. Bach have. They're alive. You can rediscover this genius. It's not this esoteric formula. God knows where the hell the guy got it from. It's a functional form of actually applying oneself to a historical process and applying that process to developing that process for the future. And that's what we're doing. I mean, people are welcome. Take the trek out to Montreal. Organize for a week with us. Actually get a sense of how the population is thinking. Take bundles of literature with us, with you. Start organizing your friends. In Ottawa, it's interesting, right? You see this thing in Seattle, right? We organize a community, and the community comes out and organizes the political leader. In Ottawa, that is precisely the set of circumstances that can change the political establishment here. People got to realize this greeny Arnie Schwarzenegger, David Suzuki thing is just neoconservatism. The green facade. It's not human to tell people they can't drink water. It's not human to say that CO2, the basis of a plant's diet and the compositional basis of your actual physical structure, is a poison. Yeah, and this is Africa's problem. Is it's been a political decision to deny them that human right.
To deny them
that human right to drink.
Well, give them filter straws to drink dirty water.
Yeah, right. And condoms and internet porn. That's going to be Africa's solution. And mosquito nets.
Mm-hmm. I don't even think water is a human right in Canada, actually.
Yeah, and the states are places you can't drink it.
Washington, D.C.
So, that's essentially it, I guess. People have questions?
When are you going to Montreal?
Huh?
When are you going to Montreal?
Tonight?
Okay.